little something between you and me. Don't cost you nothing, this one's for free.
Hannah, not your real name clearly, but I wonder, thank you so much for coming to discuss with me. We talked last week about some emotional health difficulties that you were having and your previous diagnosis of depression and your current fear of becoming depressed again. And we elected, amongst other things, for you to come back to talk to me today. And the objective of asking you to come back to talk to me today was not just to help you to plan what you wanted to do to protect you from emotional health difficulties, but to help other people that would be listening to this recording make their own decisions on the basis of the evidence that we have of what works.
Yes.
For stress symptoms, for anxiety symptoms, for depression symptoms. What would be useful really for the listening public, I think, would be to try and condense the story that you and I shared last week. I'm going to present briefly in a nutshell what we got out of last week's consultation, because that might be quite helpful for the listening public. So up until 2 weeks ago, your general emotional health had been fine. You'd had an episode many moons ago where you'd been depressed for very good reasons. And this happened at the time. Could you just remind me of this was related to your...
It was at the time when I was teaching.
Yeah.
And it was the time where I thought I could do anything and I was better than anybody else. And I would show them I could get a deputy headship, and I did. Mm. And when I got it, I hated it. It was dreadful.
Mm.
And so I wanted out of it, and I couldn't get out of it without losing face. And at that time, it meant a lot to me,
yeah.
The losing face. I have to say at this stage, you know, that book you gave me to read, and I downloaded it. I've read to chapter 14.
Oh, wonderful.
My godfathers, it's heavy reading, isn't it?
Can be.
Ooh.
So we're doing, just for the sake of people listening in, we're talking about a book called Feeling Good. It's written by a chap called David D. Byrne.
Yes.
And it's to try and empower people to think about the way that their actions and behaviours affect their emotional health and vice versa.
Yes.
So it's a kind of CBT done by yourself, really.
Yes.
Okay, so that... and I'm going to come back to that when we're exploring what might work for you. And I'd like to have your take on that.
Mm.
So, but you had a dreadful episode of depression related to taking on the deputy headship.
And it
took quite some time to fix that. But what's happened over the course of the last 11 months is that you've had a dreadful series of stresses in the family, mostly deaths in the family, which have really had their toll. And you've performed really well throughout all that. And then all of a sudden, you had this episode when you were away in the North York Moors where you felt dreadful and you thought, it's happening again.
Yes.
And that's why you came to see me last week.
Yes.
Prominently, from what you described to me, a lot of those symptoms were kind of anxiety symptoms.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I know you want to come back to the book.
Yeah.
But he, in those first 14 chapters, seems to talk about depression. And the whole time that I was reading it, I was thinking, I'm anxious, not depressed.
Mm. I agree. So we're going to build upon
that. But there were some things which pertained to me that I took away from it so far.
But your fear is, because you've got anxiety, I'm going to go down to where I was before, where my mood is low. And we'll talk about the distinction, because that's an important thing.
Yes.
But that's usually the doctor's job to figure out, based on what we share with the patient. But the purpose of this recording is really to try and put people in a position to understand your illness, to see how it links in with their illnesses, so that we're on the same page when it comes to the choices that you have. And often the same sort of things can help same...
Yes.
Slightly different problems.
Yes.
So anxiety and depression are very closely linked.
Yes.
And often chronic anxiety, so long-term anxieties, will trigger depression if you don't feel that things are being appropriately dealt with.
Right.
And they can be triggers for other mental health problems as well.
Yes.
So a lot of these things are interlinked.
Mm.
Okay. So the anxiety symptoms that you were experiencing were largely dry mouth, sweaty palms, feeling a sensation of a pit in your stomach,
yes,
a kind of gripping sensation in your stomach, but also feeling that your appetite was affected, that you felt nauseated eating.
Yes.
You've always had this slight tendency towards loose bowels, and that's no different from usual.
No.
But there's been no blood in your poo or anything like that. No change in your weight up until this point. But you'd been concerned about your sleep not being great, and you've been waking up in the mornings as well at about 4 o'clock. And there was a fear, could this be gravitating towards depression?
That was while I was away. That's a short-term thing.
Yeah, that's right.
I would say that in general terms, I sleep too much, which is in the book.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that's helpful to know. And there's also the fatigue that goes with your stress symptoms as well.
The fatigue, which has been separate.
Yeah.
Separate in the past, the four occasions over the year that have had this fatigue, pulling out the plugs symptoms without any mental thing, that is always there, the fatigue.
That's the context of your problem coming back to see me today. What's going to be really helpful for the sake of me helping you and also for the sake of this recording is to get a better feel for what you think is going on, what you were worried about, what you were thinking I might do or we might do together, and a little bit of context of a bit about you to understand what would potentially work for you. So understanding a little bit about your personality is really important. Can I check, personality-wise, you like neat, you like order. Can I check, you're not a repeated checker?
No, not an illness, no. I do sort of, when my husband's sort of gone round everything, I'll go round the taps to make sure they're off, because he's deaf as a post and he can't hear water, but not to the extent that it impairs my life.
Perfect. It's important also for me to touch base about other habits that potentially could impact upon emotional health. So it's useful for me to check. I don't have recorded on your records anything about alcohol misuse. Are you a drinker?
I drink.
How much would you get through in an average day?
I would drink one can of Guinness 5 nights a week and half a bottle of wine on a Sunday.
Okay. So about the government recommendation?
About the recommendation,
Fine. And you're not a smoker?
I gave up at 35 and never had another cigarette.
Brilliant. Okay, good. And in terms of substances, do you use anything?
No.
Okay. And prescribed substances from us?
I hate them with a passion. I've got the lisinopril, which I would gladly throw to the bottom of the sea.
From what we've talked about already, the thoughts are that stress has been the trigger. When you hit a barrier which is just too much for you, you take on a job that's too big for you, or life throws too many things at you that are stressful and difficult, that triggers anxiety and stress symptoms, and that then potentially causes depression.
Yes, but there's more to it than that.
Yeah, okay. Tell me more.
Right. Because I was brought up on a Cumbrian hill farm, with a family who had the Protestant work ethic, my grandma used to say, work till the day's ended and work till the day's done. And she used to roll her sleeves up and had 7 kids. And I was in that environment where to be slothful, to not to work, to not put your back into everything, to always do what you say that you're going to do was a sin. I'm not religious at all, but that Christian work, the Protestant work ethic is there ingrained into me. And that is something that has always lived with me. It's got to the stage, well, it always has been the stage, that I will work. When I was at work, I was a workaholic.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that at the beginning, when I was teaching, mm-hmm. that was to prove that I was better than anybody else and that mm-hmm. I could do anything. I could raise a family, I could run a home, I could work 5 days a week, I could teach a class of 30-odd kids.
Just on that theme, you've never been overconfident.
I have no.
In a delusional sort of way.
Where
a psychiatrist might say to you, you've got mania or hypomania, nothing like that.
No, not that. But am I allowed to mention the book?
Of course you can, briefly, because we're going to come back.
I realise that. That the book suggests that. People only live through what they achieve and that they only progress through life through approval from other people. Mm. Now, at first, when I was reading it, I thought, that's not me, which it isn't me now. Ever since I recovered from the last bout of anxiety and got myself out of the hole and did all kinds of things that were suggested in the book in order to raise my self-esteem back again, get another job that was better than the teaching job, mm-hmm. and keep on proving to myself that I could do things, but not in a way that I was bragging to other people, just to me that I was able to do things and feel better about myself.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, at the time in the teaching thing, I was buttering my own ego, but not in a sort of manic sort of way.
That's helpful to know. Good. Okay. So, in terms of your biggest fear when you talk to me, the impression that I got was that your fear was you're going to get depressed and there's going to be no way out of that pit.
Because that happened to me last time, that I let myself get far too far into it. Yeah. And the only way out of it was going into the mental institution and being on.
Did that happen last time?
Yes.
Right.
But I put myself in. Okay. The doctor came out to see me and said, in those days, in 1979.
You weren't sectioned, though.
I wasn't sectioned.
You put yourself in.
I think at the time.
But that was a fear, wasn't it? Can I check? Other people might fear suicide or self-harm or anything, none of that?
Never, ever, because I think at the time, and even now maybe, people are only sectioned if they're in danger of hurting themselves or other people, and that time there were people with me.
Yeah, people might be sectioned if they're not willing to seek support and help, so if you're willing to seek support and help, then there would be no sectioning necessary.
Yeah.
So your expectations when you came to see me last week were that we would do what together?
The immediate thing that I wanted was for you to be willing to give me some kind of medication. Even though I hate medication, I just knew that I wanted it as a backstop, really. I wanted it there as a security. And in my handbag, I've got two of those tablets and some water.
Mm-hmm.
So far, I took one tablet.
Yeah.
The fact that they're there.
Yeah.
And I took it the first day so that I could sleep during the night because I didn't want to wake up with that horrendous feeling. And I didn't.
Sure.
Now, whether that was psychological or whether it really worked, I don't know. But it's there and that's what I wanted. But I didn't want to be on medication
much. a medication that would help you cope with the worst fears. So something for severe anxiety.
The immediate feeling of severe anxiety that I felt when I was looking at you like this and thinking, I've got to have something that's got to take this feeling away. That was number one.
Sure.
And then after that, I was willing to discuss other options which would maybe help.
And we gave you an enormously powerful and effective treatment that has some risks.
Mm.
And we outlined those risks and shared that with you, and we came to a decision that you were safe to be using that sort of treatment as a backstop.
Yes.
And it's kind of like a comfort blanket, as you said, to have
something
like that as a plan to hand, small quantities that you're not going to be able to abuse, but short term it's safe and very effective if you really need to use it.
Yeah.
But often just knowing that you've got that there is enough to help you deal with the biggest fear that you've got.
Mm.
Really helpful. Okay. Hannah, that's been wonderful to get a better feel for what's going on. In terms of a diagnosis, you're stressed by what's happened to you over the course of the last 11 months. There's been a number of bereavements and a lot going on. And a lot of that has felt at times to be overwhelming. And there was a final trigger in this illness where you thought, it's all coming back. And you've noticed, interestingly, that you sometimes get what are probably called functional symptoms. So symptoms that there's no physical reason for them, but they're linked in with your emotions. And probably we wouldn't find anything if we looked into those. But where you think that you might have a real illness, such as a water infection, let's test you for that. Let's definitely see you if you've got blood in your urine. Let's definitely see you if you're losing weight, or things that would potentially worry me as well as worry you. At the moment, you're not suffering with depression, but you have a past history of depression, and it was quite a deep depression, bad enough for you to elect to go into a mental institution, a mental hospital at the time. And that took considerable treatment and also internal resources, and you got better, and you've stayed better for a long time, and you've also got good resources for protecting you in the long-term future, and you've got a good network of friends and family to support you, well protected, no suggestion of any suicidal thoughts or thoughts of self-harm. You've got your personality, and your personality is going to be crucial in terms of your choices of what works for you in terms of what do you do to protect yourself in the future from depression, and what do you do to deal with some of the stress symptoms and the anxiety that you suffer. You're not a drug user or a substance misuser. There's no suggestion to me that you've ever had any psychotic illness. And the psychotic illness is where you lose perspective completely. You don't know what reality is or otherwise. You've never been manic, where you've been overconfident. You've never had a deep enough depression to need to have some of the more drastic treatments that some people might think of, which are still used on occasions. So electroconvulsive therapy is a very effective treatment for deep depression, very effective. It does have some side effects in terms of memory loss, but it's not the sort of thing that we're talking about for you. And I don't have much evidence in terms of the numbers for how safe and how effective it is, but it's there. And some people need to use it, and for some people it's extremely effective and life-saving. We're not, in your case, dealing at all with being concerned about self-harm, we don't think. But there are some treatments that potentially might increase your risk of self-harm, and it's worth touching upon those as we go through the various different options. But we're not thinking that that's something that we need to protect you from. It's worthwhile mentioning alcohol because it's so prevalent and so important, in that I find that people who are drinking very heavily usually don't get better from depression, because the alcohol is such a deep depressant that it keeps people. And unless I can help them with their drinking, I can't help them with their depression. And just to talk a little bit about that co-diagnosis of the combined diagnosis of anxiety, stress, and depression, they often go hand in hand. If you're in stress for a long period of time, or you feel very worked up for a long period of time, it's really common for that to result in depression, where your mood is low. And when your mood is low, a combination of problems can often result. And this is why, when we talked last week, it was worthwhile me just understanding the symptoms that you were getting. Quite commonly, sleep is affected. And commonly with deep depression, you find that you wake up early in the morning and you feel more dreadful first thing in the morning. You might find that your appetite is affected and that you don't feel like eating so much, and that can cause you to lose weight. You might lose interest in things that are going on around you, including your sex life might be affected. So these are really common things that often happen in depression, and they're often triggered by stress. So it's worthwhile. And often the same things that we do to treat anxiety will be effective to treat depression and vice versa. So it's worthwhile just being aware that we're talking about the combination of problems in pretty much the same way. I'd like to share with you, if we can, some choices for you, and I'm going to frame it around or hang it around things that I'm guessing from our earlier conversation might potentially work for you. And I'm going to try and give you some evidence so that it works for other people to understand this. So I've got a tool here. Unfortunately, it's in very small writing, so it's going to be difficult for both of us to read it at the same time. But if you can lean forward, potentially you might be able to see a little bit more about it. So the basic four options that you've got for managing anxiety, stress, and depression symptoms are, you already mentioned what you wanted in the first instance was a medication that you could take to help you know that if things got dreadful, that you could cope. So medication is one option, but that's on one side of the decision. In the middle of that, there are talking therapies where you actually get a therapist who talks to you and involves you and figures out with you what would work for you, and you get therapy. And that could take many forms. That might be cognitive behavioral therapy, or it might be mindfulness, or it might be a number of old modalities of type of treatment, which could include things like counselling. So those sorts of things. And a lot of these have a lot of evidence, and we'll talk about the evidence in a minute. There could be things which are very much uncertain in terms of the evidence base, but actually are probably effective to a large extent, which is things that you do in your life to make you feel better. Mm. So lifestyle changes could be exercise, it could be self-help things that you decided that you wanted, or it could be a book where you're giving yourself the same sort of therapies that talking therapies would do. And actually, that's something, after talking a little bit with you last time, that I'd suggested to you because I thought that you probably had the energy to do that, and that would probably potentially work for you. So I've offered you that. So that's one of the options. And the other one is just you coming to me on maybe a regular basis, but at least up until the point where we feel that things are getting better, to talk about these problems, to try and figure out, and to help you to figure out what you want to do about them. That's kind of called watchful waiting. And it's kind of it's a hands-off, no drugs, no specific therapy approach where we leave you to very much do the things that you want to do. But there's evidence for all of these potential approaches, and I'm going to try and put you in a position to be able to decide what type of therapy would work for you in the long term, if that's okay, depending on your decisions. So just a little bit about each of them. Shall we start with what you want to start with? Out of all of those things, what grabs you?
I don't want to take a sledgehammer to crack a nut. I feel as though, having seen you once last week, even before I took any medication, the fact that I'd spoken to you, that you listened to me empathetically, that you understood what I was saying, you understood my absolute stress and anxiety at the time, and having offloaded myself on somebody like you, who's a professional, I went out of the door and I felt it lifting off. Now, I needed the medication for one night because I didn't want to wake up stressed the next morning. Mm-hmm. I woke up with a head that was all full of fluff and everything else, but at least that horrible, horrible anxiety feeling wasn't there. Because it wasn't there, I felt more positive about things and thought, it can be lifted. It is lifting. Always thinking, it might come back. Mm-hmm. And the positivity of that kept me going through the day. My children were saying, if you need to take the tablets, you need to take the tablets. And I said, I feel okay. I'm feeling okay without them. I don't want to be taking them during the day. I don't think I'll need to take one during the night. And as time's gone on, I felt more and more confident that with the tablet as the backstop, I don't know how quickly it would take failing away if I got it back again. Mm. I've got to trust in that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And so
I'm going to remind the listening audience that the tablets that we prescribed was a tiny amount, a very small number of tablets of the smallest dose of diazepam. Yes. And that diazepam was there as a backstop rather than a treatment.
Yes.
And we talked about the potential problems with some people who might have a dependence on tablets or might have side effects with using the tablets, but they are a very good treatment for anxiety over a short period of time when you really need something that's going to work. So you've now got that backstop to take something if you really need it.
If I need it. Yeah. So at the moment, what I am feeling is that one anxiety is that I'm going to do a very similar walking holiday on the 16th of June.
Yeah.
And because that happened to me, suddenly, when I walk through the door of a cottage, it should go away, but it won't go away, that when I go through the door of that cottage, it'll just suddenly come back to me. And I think it might be self-prophesying that I'm thinking it so that it might happen.
Got you.
And I'm thinking, I've got the tablets though, but will they work? And I'm not at home. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I've got to trust that I can think myself out of it and that I've got the tablets as a backstop. And from what you suggest, I would feel all right about having access to you on a regular basis, not loads of times, but because I trust you and wouldn't like to meet somebody else and have somebody else at this stage who I need to tell the whole story to over again, that I feel that if it's possible, I would like the access to you on a short-term basis.
Well, I what I'm going to do is just to generalise to other people. So access to your own relationship with a clinician that you trust, other people might call it using the doctor as a drug, is a very effective tool. So we're potentially going down a drug-free avenue at the moment.
Yes.
And that seems very appropriate because we're thinking that you're low risk in terms of you going into a deep depression.
Mm.
Low risk. It's not happened for decades.
No.
So it's probably not going to happen, but you've been through enormous stresses and we need to know how to manage those stresses. Mm. But I'm just going to talk a little bit about, so that access to me as a doctor, I'm just going to give you a feel for how that might work to you.
Yes.
So we met last week. We're meeting again today to try and figure out what would potentially work in the future. And I'm accessible on the phone better than I am.
So, yes, I realise that.
Because I've been in this practice for 20 years and a lot of people know me, and getting the face-to-face appointments might be a little bit difficult unless I'm a duty doctor. But if you need to talk to me, then I'm there for you on the phone without too much difficulty.
Yes.
And we can always make a contract as to what would be useful to you and what would be effective each time we meet.
Yes.
And then we can let the tether get a bit longer and allow you to decide how long that tether needs to be and how to access me. But you can always get in touch with me if you need to.
Yes.
And I've got a team around me also that will allow you access to them if you needed a face-to-face appointment with the duty doctor that's on. So that's potentially what watchful waiting might look like to you.
Yes.
And my gut instinct is that that could be a very preferred option. But there's nothing to say that that's the only option that you want to use.
Yes.
So I'm going to outline some of the other things within these different options.
Mm.
So we talked a little bit about what watchful waiting. Mm. I'll give you a copy of this to take away because it's quite helpful for somebody like you who'd like to know in depth how things work to be able to explore these, because there's no way in this meeting that I'm going to be able to tell you everything that's written down here, but I'll give you some highlights from it, if that's okay.
Mm.
So a little bit about watchful waiting. One of the other things that you've already started to explore without a therapist is doing your own lifestyle changes. Yeah? And doing is important to you, so keep on doing. And I'm not putting limitations on that, but you've already started to put limitations on yourself in terms of, you know, when you get frazzled, you know, when you're doing too much. So it needs to be enjoyable, but there needs to be a sense of achievement. That's important to you. But you now have a better understanding, hopefully, of the way you used to work and the way that you work now from having read Feeling Good. So this is this cognitive behavioral therapy book that David D. Burns has written. It's an enormously positive tool because it puts you in the driving seat of choosing the way that you're going to behave. And there's a very close relationship between the way that you behave and the way that you feel, and vice versa. So you can control the way that you feel most of the time by doing the things that make you feel good, and vice versa. So if you start to feel negative, you can often go into negative behaviors as a consequence of that. And if you catch yourself doing that, you can actually consciously change your behaviors to make you feel better. Those are really important principles of what cognitive behavioral therapy is. Now, in terms of numbers of what works and what doesn't work in that respect, I don't have the numbers for self-help interventions. Just don't have the statistics, but I can give you the numbers for what works for talking therapists. So for things like cognitive behavioral therapy, can tell you how effective that is, if that's helpful to you.
It's in the book, I think, isn't it? But then that's 20 years ago, and it might have been updated.
Well, I'll give you some current numbers if that's helpful to you. So the talking therapist side of things. We're talking about treating depression, and you're not depressed at the moment, but it gives a flavour of how effective this type of thing can be in terms of long-term protection. So if I put my glasses on and have a closer look at what's here, we would find that if 100 of my patients went to see a cognitive behavioral therapist and had 6 sessions and were treating them all for depression, we would find that 41 would get better.
Right.
Just with that treatment.
Yeah. Totally better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
41 out of 100 get totally better. 15 out of 100 get a worthwhile improvement on top of that.
Yes. Yeah, all right.
So they're quite marked improvements just on the basis of this is a group of 100 people who've got depression, and we're giving them this as a choice, and 41 of them are actually getting better in that time. And we would think that that's going to be long-term protection because they're changing their behavior and they have the opportunity for that to give without any medication, for them to get better in the long term as a consequence of changing the way that they act and the way that they feel, and that how tightly those two things are bonded together. So there are different types of talking therapy available, as well as cognitive behavioral therapy. And I've got numbers for the cognitive behavioral therapy rather than the other things, but that's one of the ones that works. There's a lot of talk at the moment about mindfulness, and mindfulness is extremely helpful, particularly for anxiety symptoms.
So
that can be something that's
worthwhile.
Everybody
talks, everybody has the book about mindfulness.
So again, these are safe treatments.
Yes.
I've not heard of any significant problems in using this treatment, whereas a lot of people are anxious about the use of medications. We're going to touch on medications. I know that you're not. You mentioned that you wanted a therapy, you wanted a treatment that would be there for you if you needed it. But at the moment, we're kind of, I'm detecting in your face that tablets are not the right thing for you to be taking regularly.
No.
Okay.
Because of the fact that last time I became addicted to the medication, and it took me a long time to get off. And I remember the feeling of banging my head against the wall and scraping my fingers down the wall thinking, I'm going to get off these. It was dreadful and I never ever want to be addicted.
Do you remember the name of those that medication?
One of them was diazepam.
Okay.
And there was another one as well, but diazepam was one that I had to take if I felt up a height.
Yes.
But there was another one, I can't remember what it was at the time. I don't even think amitriptyline had been invented then or anything like that.
I suspect it has because you've been around an awful long time.
Has it?
It's one of the really early medications.
Is it? I wasn't on that.
Yeah, okay. But you were
I can't remember what the other one was, but it was a blue one and it was every day.
I seem to remember, I look back on your medication and I didn't see a record of that. Maybe I should be delving deeper into your paper records and see if I can find that.
Have you got records that go all the way back to my birth?
Should have. We'll have a look. We'll share that on another occasion.
But for now,
if you had been somewhat inclined, I want to address your fears for the sake of everyone else that's listening.
Yes.
So diazepam is addictive. You use it a long period of time. It has a tendency for you to find it difficult to stop.
Mm-hmm.
That's your definition of addiction.
Yes.
It's an enormously powerful drug, so it gives you a psychological dependence, so you kind of, if you take it frequently over a long period of time, usually you have to take it for 3 weeks continuously before you have this potential problem where you're going to find it difficult.
Six months.
So it is, then you then have to wean yourself off because mm-hmm. you'll get mm-hmm. some mm-hmm. physical symptoms when you stop.
Yeah.
But emotionally it's difficult to stop too.
Yeah,
so, yes, it's difficult to stop that family of medication if you're using them regularly. If you're using them once in a blue moon when you really, really need to, not a problem. And we do still use things like diazepam, they're benzodiazepines as a family. We still do use them on occasions and they can be extremely mm-hmm. useful.
Mm-hmm.
But that wouldn't be the first choice for you to be using regularly.
No.
Modern antidepressant medications, the vast majority of them are not addictive as such. But when we come to choices of medications, because I'm going to ask you to mock up, if you were to choose a medication, what medication would you choose? And I've got a tool to help us with that decision-making process.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to come through that decision-making process with me a little bit later on. But as a broad brush at the moment, they're not an addictive thing. But some people do get symptoms coming off the medication.
Yeah.
And there's a subtle, distinction.
Yes, I understand what you're saying.
So, antidepressants in a group of people with various levels of different severity of depression, that if you gave medication to 100 patients, we would find that 51 of them would get better with their symptoms of depression. But here's the proviso. So 51 in 100, which still means that we're leaving half the patients without substantial benefit from taking antidepressants. And if we gave you a placebo pill, 38 out of 100 people would get better anyway. So we don't know where that's coming from, but my gut instinct is to say to you, a lot of that's to do with talking, watching, waiting as we talk mm-hmm. to the doctor as a drug, or you problem solving for yourself and figuring out mm-hmm. what makes you feel better. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those things actually work.
Yeah.
So how much so my instinct usually with a patient that comes to me and we make a diagnosis of depression is to say, well, medication's there, but why don't we just see you again in maybe a week's time, and then if you really, really want to take medication, we can give you medication.
Yeah.
But I need to put you in a picture to be able to find out what the potential drawbacks of medication could be before making that decision.
Yes.
We've got various questions, and I want to try and hone in on the ones that might be of interest to you
mm-hmm.
with these various different options. So we've got on the left-hand side of this table, we have what we could talk about. We've already mentioned what the treatment, each of these treatments is.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned something of the evidence of how helpful they might be and when they might not be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
There's mention of adding treatments together, so I'll just touch upon that. There's nothing to stop you from having all four treatments. So watchful waiting, seeing your doctor regularly, seeing your therapist regularly, doing your own thing, which is kind of deciding what works for you. Mm. Also having a talking therapy, a proper talking therapy, a talking therapist, and also taking medications. You might well find that having more of those things together could work for you. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing to stop you from doing that. How long does it take to get better? Mm. We usually expect that with a therapy that, well, let's start with antidepressant medication. If we give you a medicine such as an antidepressant, and we're talking mostly about the most common antidepressant medication that most doctors use these days, and the safest ones, and that aren't addictive, are predominantly from a class called the SSRI medications. So these are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And what that means is they're aimed at boosting the levels of serotonin in your brain to make you more cheerful. They're not quite a happy drug, but they're to try and take some of the sadness away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they do have a risk. We're going to talk about risks in a second, but it's worthwhile just being aware that they're not all positive things. Okay. So how long does it take for that to get into your system to work? Well, if you're just taking them for anxiety, and they do work for anxiety, that class of medication, then quite often they work really quickly. Mm-hmm. So if you had anxiety symptoms that are there with you all the time, rather than just that fear that comes out of the blue, that you can manage with activities or with cognitive or thinking therapies or that family of options, then medication and you're feeling anxious all the time will often work extremely quickly. Mm. So SSRIs, that family of medication, will often work extremely quickly for that side of things. But there is a tiny risk, as I mentioned before, that they can make you behave unusually. So it can sometimes make you feel quite excited and overexcited and potentially really quite worked up. And that's quite unusual. Most people find that they feel calmer on this medication, but there's a tiny minority. So when we start people on that family of medication, we always say to them, look, the chances are this will make you feel calmer, but there's a possibility that it could give you a bit too much and you could feel too much on edge. So theoretically, that can also increase the risk of self-harm because people feel desperate when that happens.
Right.
So we always say, look, if it does make you feel really over anxious, then stop them and let us know straight away. We might need to change your treatment a little bit to try and work that one out.
Mm. Okay. Right.
There are some other downsides of those medications. I'll come back to those in a second, if that's okay. For pure depression, we normally expect that you won't see a response until you've been on them for at least a couple of weeks. We want to make sure that you're not having side effects that mean that you're not intolerant, so we may see you more often than that in the first instance. Mm. And it may be up to 3 or 4 weeks before you see a worthwhile improvement. So the suggestion that we've got here, in this box here, that the GP might see you every 2 to 4 weeks in the first 3 months to make sure that you're getting better if we're treating you with medication.
Mm.
And that's not a bad kind of idea of how often would you need to be seen to make sure that you're going in the right direction.
Yeah.
But quite often, it might well be that you come to see your GP to make a diagnosis in the first instance. If he's doing the right thing, usually I would recommend that they don't treat you with medication on the first occasion, that they say, treatment's there, we'll think about it,
yes.
It's not too deep, you can keep yourself safe, let me see you next week and let's make a plan then. Mm. And then if you really want medication next week, we could start it then. And then probably they want to see you again a couple of weeks later to make sure it's going in the right direction. And there's always the telephone. And then we might want to just stretch it a little bit for the following review. And that could be a telephone review, just to make sure before you're running out of tablets that you're going in the right direction and that you've got some other support.
Mm.
But that might be the way that we would manage that follow-up for you. So we've got a table here which outlines those four treatment options. And then we have questions on the left-hand side which try and help us figure out what could be useful to you
to know at this stage?
I would want to do the watchful waiting. I would want to know that as long as you were available, I could speak to you to let you know how I was getting on or if I had any anxieties or any recurrences.
Yeah.
And I would like a sort of reassurance that the tablets that I'm using as a backstop actually would work as a backstop, as a sort of, oh my God, I'm going into depression, I need to take a tablet now, I feel better. I don't know whether you could say that one.
Okay, I'll try and give you a better feel for that. Okay, what I'm thinking would be helpful for you to know at this stage probably would be, what are the downsides of each choice?
Right.
Is that helpful?
Yes, except that at the moment I'm not really to be persuaded in any shape or form that taking medication, any kind of medication long term at the moment, is an option, because of the fact that I've been there before taking medication. Okay. And I really I don't want medication.
No, I think we've got diazepam that you've got in your pocket that you carry around with you just in case that you really needed it. And you've also got the potential that Dr. Birrell could prescribe for you in the future a medication that could deal with a deep depression if it was there. That's a backstop.
Yes.
It's a kind of fail-safe. But because we already know you, that you've got enormous resilience and protective factors, and you've had decades without depression, the chances are that... I never want to say never, because most people have times in their life where things are deep and dark and difficult, and they become anxious, they become stressed, and some of them become depressed.
Yeah.
So you never say never.
Never say never.
But we know that you've got enormous resilience and ability to protect yourself. So there's always that as a backstop.
Yeah.
It's useful for you to understand a bit about... how likely are you to have problems with each of the options that we're going to share with you? So we're going to talk through that. Watchful waiting was one of those things, and we're not just going for watchful waiting, but if we just watched you, we then do have those backstops. We have the backstops where we've got all the other treatment options that you could come to if you needed to. Yeah. So that's there.
Yes.
Self-help treatments, on the whole, are safe, as long as they've been researched effectively, and some of them haven't. So there are not many that are unsafe, but there are herbal treatments, I'm using air quotes but herbal treatments I've got some serious reservations about herbal treatments, because just because they are not put into a capsule or not put into a tablet doesn't mean they're not drugs, because they are drugs.
Yes.
And the danger that we have with those is that a lot of them are not researched, and we can't quantify how effective they are, and we can't quantify how dangerous they might be.
Mm.
But some of them are dangerous. And I'm just going to highlight one of them in particular that could be an issue, because it's commonly used, which is St. John's wort.
I knew you were going to say St. John's wort.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it can be partly effective for mild to moderate depression.
Yeah.
I say unfortunately, it is, but it's not as good as the commonly used SSRI medications like fluoxetine and sertraline. It's not as effective as them, but it has more risks than them.
Do you buy it at the chemist, or do you just take it out of the garden?
Usually you buy it at the health food shop.
You don't just go in the garden and find some of it and have a chew at it. I'm not into herbal anyway.
No.
I know, I understand all of what you say about them.
I'm sure there's a spectrum of the way people take it, but it's difficult to quantify what you're getting when you get one of these.
No.
And the research that's gone into them is lacking, and it's common to have allergic reactions, particularly with the skin, common to have stomach upsets, common to have pains, nerve pains, and sensitivity to sunlight. And they interact with other medicines as well. So always tell your doctor that you're thinking about taking them. Your doctor may tell you some of the pros and cons as to whether or not they think it's sensible or safe. But if you're inclined to use a herbal medication, why not use a herbal medication that's prescribed for you that we know is at least a bit more safe and we can quantify the risks? And that's what I'm going to say about that side.
There's no risk that I'm going to go down that route.
There's a lot of debate about how effective other self-help treatments are, and on the whole, when you're feeling good about yourself because you're exercising and you're managing your weight better, if you were overweight and you're not, then often that can be a way of tackling the way that you feel. So it's really worthwhile exercising for that sake, although there are various reports as to how effective exercise can be. I would suggest that it's at least not harmful and probably has some very major positive benefits in terms of your general health as well. So being conscious of your weight, being conscious of your exercise levels, those are important factors as well. We've delved a little bit into talking therapies without really knowing and without making a conscious decision to do so, because you've started delivering your own talking therapies by going deeply into cognitive behavioral therapy treatments without actually having a therapist. So you're your own therapist at the moment. That is a treatment that could be available to you. Perhaps I could ask you a little bit about your thoughts.
I might be being a bit unkind, but my perception of people who deliver talking therapy is that they have been on a six-week course and then they think they know it all, and I'm thinking, no, I don't want this. Now, I may be way, way off the mark with it, with the people who deliver these courses.
Okay. The majority of the talking therapies that are delivered locally in Sunderland are delivered by very professional organisations where a lot of them have extensive training as community psychiatric nurses. So if you've got reservations, then check what their qualifications are to ensure that you're happy that they're trained to the sort of level that you'd expect. But yeah, there's horses for courses. If you go to a counsellor, you might find that they've got that kind of six-week training course behind under their belt, and that's going to affect your faith in them. And your faith in them is so important.
Well, absolutely.
So part of the reason you come to see me is because I've gone through medical school and I've been a GP for an awful long time, and I train and I teach, and as a consequence, I'm constantly improving and trying to improve the delivery of the service that I can give to people. Whereas you want to know that you're an intelligent lady, you've been professionally qualified yourself, you worked as a teacher and then as a deputy head, and you've got standards and you've got someone, you've got to be able to connect with them. So you're going to need somebody who has more than a superficial training.
Yes.
That's really important.
Yeah.
It's not going to work without that faith and understanding that you've got somebody who's going to be able to delve a bit.
Yes.
Yeah. So make sure that if you committed to that, that you've got somebody who's got the appropriate qualification behind them. So I would recommend that a community psychiatric nurse has got that.
Yes. Okay.
Almost certainly. You won't always get on with your therapist, and sometimes you'll have to find a different therapist to get the right therapy for you.
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't find that they always connect, and it doesn't always work for everyone. So we presented some of the numbers, and I suspect that the reason that you don't get 100% of response is probably because we got 41%, didn't we? Well, actually, we got 41 that got better, and we got 15 out of 100 that improved.
Yeah.
So quite a lot. I mean, it's a good response, isn't it? But a lot of that might be just individually on that relationship and that trust and that belief that that therapist is going to be able to help them and can understand where they're coming from. But also it's a two-way process. You've got to be able to communicate effectively with them as well as vice versa.
Yeah.
So apart from that kind of personality clash and that lack of faith, then it's a safe way to go. So that's always available to you.
Yeah.
So there doesn't seem to be much of a risk behind that type of treatment. we're going to major a little bit in side effects, because the side effects of medication, I know we are not electing medication now, but for the sake of completeness for this recording, it'd be really helpful for me to tell a little bit more about the risks and the side effects of medications. Mm. So the most commonly used antidepressants that GPs prescribe these days are called SSRIs, and they're to try and improve serotonin levels.
Yeah.
One of the things that potentially they can do is they can irritate the lining of the bowel and the stomach, and they make you more prone to bleeding. It's a tiny risk, but it's there. Mm. It's no worse than taking a baby aspirin a day. Mm. But if you were to take aspirin and that every day, we might need to be thinking about protecting your stomach. Mm. And you certainly need to be aware to watch out for symptoms that might suggest that you've got a bleeding ulcer in your stomach.
Yeah.
So persistent upper tummy pain, black tarry poo, or feeling dreadfully faint or unwell. Mm. So those could be suggestions that the medications is not the right thing for you, and that you would need to seek urgent medical care. Just people do have bleeding ulcers for other reasons too. So I don't combine anti-inflammatory painkillers with SSRIs, that family of medication, fluoxetine and sertraline, without thinking about protecting the stomach. And it's really common to have other side effects, particularly when you first start on these medications. And the commonest of those would be nausea, diarrhea, and potentially drowsiness. And we get about 17 out of 100 patients that are on that class of medication having significant side effects in that respect. I'm going to outline a couple of additional things as well, if that's okay. But usually when I see a patient, I'll highlight those two issues, the bleeding risk and the risk of temporary side effects, and also the risk that potentially they might be agitated.
Right.
That agitated side of things is really uncommon, but it's so important we mustn't miss it.
Yeah.
And if somebody was starting to feel very worked up, that potentially can present a risk that they might self-harm or do something very drastic. So it's really important that we warn them that that's a possibility, but it's pretty small print that they need to know about it. Much further down the line of potential problems could include sexual problems as well. And possibly the commonest ones of those, it's an issue for men rather than for women. And the issue mostly is that they have delayed ejaculation.
Mm.
So when they're having sex, it takes them a while before they can ejaculate. And that can be a problem, a considerable problem. And there are other potential risks as well. But they do tend to be fairly small print. So if that would be a concern, and they wouldn't want to be delayed, in fact, we sometimes use it as a treatment for people that are ejaculating too quickly. So if that could be a problem that would be a deal breaker, then we would change to something that wouldn't cause those side effects. There's a whole choice of different antidepressants. I'm going to finish this part of the recording now, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about how do you make your choice of antidepressants.
Let's hear it for our GP. Skills improving, risk removing, no confusion.